This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings once again to everybody at TFMR. Hey, it is Thursday, December the 5th, 2019. It is time for a Thursday conversation, man, with the holiday and last week and everything else has been going on. We haven't had a Thursday conversation for a few weeks, so I'm happy to have one for you today. And I'm also happy to get a chance to invite in as a guest a guy I've known for a while, but we've just never had a chance to do this. And I'm talking about John Rubino. Many of you, I mean, if you've been following the metals for any length of time, you probably know who John Rubino is. I mean, he's an author. He's written a couple of great books that we'll talk about here in a minute. He's also the publisher of a great website, dollarcollapse.com. And he's been a longtime ally in the fight for sound money, proper pricing of the precious metals, all that stuff. And so it's a real pleasure to know John, and it's just great to finally get a chance to talk to him in this format. So John, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, Craig. Yeah, it's good we finally get to do this. It has been a long, long time.
Hey, but before we get started, I kind of butcher things as I go along. Tell everybody a little bit, put it in your own words. Tell them about your work at Dollar Collapse.
Well, dollarcollapse.com is a kind of a news aggregation / blog site where I just post my own thoughts and then pick up a lot of news links on basically on the dark side of the financial system. You know, all the mistakes we're making and all the bad consequences that are likely to flow from those mistakes. So the idea is, you know, show up there once a day and you're kind of up to date on that side of things.
Kind of, you know, I think of it as, I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but it's kind of like a Drudge Report in a sense, as an aggregator of headlines. You know, because when I go there, I find all kinds of news links that I missed, you know, and I find it very, very helpful. I mean, I don't want to, you know, categorize it just simply as that, but that's sure, I think, great value.
Yeah, because there's a lot going on out there, and a lot of it is kind of under the surface where you wouldn't normally see it if you pick up your New York Times in the morning or even your Wall Street Journal. So, yeah, there is a lot of value to be added by pointing out the things that are happening under the surface that you don't necessarily see in the mainstream media. Right. And, you know, the links list that I post, and I also do a top 10 videos of the week page. And those are things that if I had unlimited time, I would be reading and watching. So right. I don't actually get to read all of that or watch everything that I post, but it's the stuff that I would be reading. So it's there for you if you have more time than me.
Right. And who has that amount of time, yeah. Right? I mean, and I try, everybody here knows I do my best to try to find that stuff, but I can't find, you know, who can? And so you've got to have sources that you can go to that aggregate this stuff for you. And again, dollarcollapse.com. I mean, you should put that in your favorites bar, everybody listening, you know, so you can go there and like you said, at least once a day and just make sure you're not missing out on stuff. John, as I was explaining to you before, you know, these Thursday conversations are kind of a shorter format. We try to get right to the point because, again, who has time to listen to, you know, an hour long deal? And so I've got three main topics that I want to discuss with you. We always try to keep it to three main topics. I think I want to start with your experience over the past 15 plus years, in that you've written a couple books with Mr. Turk about, I always call him Mr. Turk. I can't help it. Anyway, about the, well, like the second one in 2014 was called The Money Bubble. Your site is Dollar Collapse. I mean, this is all part of what I call the end of the great Keynesian experiment. You know, eventually the system reverts back to some form of sound money. It just always seems to happen. And that would be a popping of this money bubble that you wrote about 5 years ago. So again, though, that book was 5 years ago. Where are we here at the end of the decade? What are you seeing? Are we progressing along that path? Are we moving? Is de-dollarization a big part of it? Just your best summary about, you know, how things look here in 2019.
Yeah, well, one thing that's clear is that my take on the timing of this stuff is not worth anything, you know, because I really thought that everything was going to fall apart a lot sooner than it did. You know, the numbers were really impossible in the 2000s. You know, it looked, everything was at record levels in terms of debt and leverage and all the pathologies of fiat currency financial systems. And it looked like the system would have to break down pretty shortly. You know, I thought 2005, 2006 would be the end of the road. And we almost saw that happen. You know, there was a near-death experience in the global financial system in 2008, 2009. But the world's central banks just flooded the system with newly created currency and basically bought us another decade. But at a cost of basically a further doubling of global debt. You know, now we owe so much, and every level of every major society is so highly leveraged that we're incredibly fragile. But I you know, obviously, I'm not going to go out on a limb and say, well, I think it happens this year or next year, because I have no credibility about the timing of any of this.
Yeah, me too.
But clearly, it's the imbalances are building, and they're already unmanageable. So the further we go down this road, just it becomes a question of when, not if. It's clearly going to happen. The system can't keep going like this, and there's no way to reverse out this kind of debt painlessly. You know, you can only get rid of a huge overhang of debt two ways. One is everybody defaults and goes bankrupt and the debt goes away and you have a 1930s style depression, or the governments of the world devalue their currencies so aggressively that it becomes possible to pay off existing debts in way cheaper currency, which is inflation, really, you know, a big inflation. So there's exactly one rational, relatively pain-free way of getting out of this. And it's not pain-free at all, but it's the closest to pain-free that we have. And that is something that Jim Rickards talks about, where we do a monetary reset. Some Sunday night, the government just announces, hey, starting tomorrow morning, on Monday morning, the dollar will henceforth be a name for 1/10,000th of an ounce of gold, and we'll be back on the gold standard. And going forward, we'll have sound money. But that destroys everyone's savings. Everybody who trusted the government and held a lot of dollar cash or bank accounts or bond funds will see their savings cut by 2/3 or 3/4. So that's where the pain will be localized then, and in the accounts of people who trusted the government. And then I think you get civil unrest in that kind of a situation. So it's not pain-free. You know, we have to get through the reaction to something like that. But the other alternatives are so much worse that I think there's at least a, you know, minuscule but real chance that the governments of the world will come to their senses and choose something like a monetary reset before a gigantic crisis forces them to do it. Much more likely is that some gigantic crisis will come along and we will lose control of the situation.
Yeah.
I think we're actively trying for door number two, the inflationary scenario, where we devalue the currencies year after year after year in the hopes that that keeps ahead of the buildup of the debt and prevents some kind of a gigantic systemic global crisis. But since debt is rising faster than anybody expected, and any amount of, you know, modest inflation can keep up with, that's not going to happen. You know, because here's one of the reasons why it actually can't or shouldn't happen in a rational world. Because when governments are inflating away their currencies, what signal does that send to you as an actor in the marketplace? It says borrow as much money as possible, right? Because you're going to pay off your debt in cheaper currency. So yeah, the value of the currency goes down, but the amount of debt in the system goes up even faster, and you get an even bigger imbalance. And that's what's happening now. The whole world is borrowing incredible amounts of money. And you know, it's not just the U.S., obviously. China quintupled its debt after the Great Depression, and Japan now, even though the government has borrowed more money per capita than any other country in human history, is finding that that's not enough. You know, they've got negative interest rates, they've got massive government deficits, and they've decided to come out with a stimulus plan this year. In other words, they're going to borrow even more money and throw it at the financial system and hope somehow that that gets their inflation rate up to 2% and gets everybody buying stuff and the economy rocking and allows GDP to grow faster than debt. But it won't work, because we've already hit the point at which new debt buys you very little in terms of wealth creation. They call that the marginal productivity of debt. And it's been plunging from, you know, around 1-to-1, where it used to be that you borrowed some money and invested it and you got an equal amount of GDP out of it. So a buck of new debt got you a new dollar of GDP. Well, now it's like $6 of debt required to generate any new GDP. And you know, when that line hits zero, in other words, when you can borrow all you want to and it gets you nothing,
right,
then it's game over. And we're headed that way.
Right.
So at some point, that's the end game. When the things they're doing now just don't work anymore. And, you know, like I said, I can't tell you when that's going to happen, but the time is certainly coming.
Right.
As these numbers get more and more unmanageable.
The math assures it. At some point, we just don't know what that point is. And you eloquently explained. I mean, your choice is either some kind of massive debt default, which is unbelievably deflationary because somebody's debt is also considered somebody's asset on the other side, right? You could massively try to inflate it away. That's also not a preferable outcome. And so you get that reset of the gold price maybe as a third, you know, way somehow try to go down the middle, which would still be a very difficult situation for anybody that owns any gold. Now, to that end, the price may get reset higher at some point on a Sunday. We don't know, some point in the future, but it may also just be trading higher as it has been for the last, really about the last 6 months. We were kind of sideways the first 4 or 5 months of this year, 2019. So knowing that the central banks now have shown their hand, John, you know, they're trying to manage an increase in the money supply, an increased amount of inflation so that they can keep the wheels spinning. Because, again, they can't afford a recession that cuts tax receipts, you know, and then the debt is even less manageable and all this kind of stuff. So we know what they're going to be doing next year. How does that impact, I mean, your own forecast? Outside of the possibility of a, like I said, a sudden price reset, relink, sound money kind of thing, are you expecting just market prices to be higher next year?
Well, the gold story is interesting on a couple of different levels. One is that, if you look around and realize that there's nothing you can do to stop what's coming. In other words, it doesn't matter who you vote for. It doesn't matter what you do with your job or anything like that. These gigantic financial crises that are now baked in the cake are going to happen. Then real assets make a lot of sense. In other words, stuff that governments can't just make on an electronic printing press in infinite quantities. And gold and silver traditionally, and remember, this has happened many times in human history when we screw up our currencies and the currency fails. So we kind of know the general shape of what's coming. Every single time since the days of the Roman Empire, gold and silver did really well in that kind of a situation because you can't make more gold and silver. You have to go dig it out of the ground. And historically, we've gotten about 2% more each year. So the supply of those kinds of money grow at more or less the rate of population growth, which is why they've held their purchasing power over 3,000 years. So that's a logical place to be. And money is flowing into precious metals. And, you know, it's been going up since it was $35 an ounce. Gold has in the 1970s. So it's logical to assume that money will continue to flow into precious metals as long as this is going on. And so that the trend in precious metals will be irregularly upward. Now, the shorter term issue is also really interesting because normally summer is the weakest time for gold and silver because Asians like to give gold and silver jewelry as wedding gifts for springtime weddings, which means they do most of their buying in the winter. And by summertime, they've stopped buying. So gold and silver usually face downward pressure in the summer. But this year, in the weakest seasonal time, precious metals went up, which means that there was other buying in the market. You know, either it was investment demand or it was central banks, which are now net buyers, loading up more or less secretly. But whatever it was, gold and silver went up in the weakest seasonal time of the year. And now we're heading into the strongest seasonal time. So the question becomes, did we just kind of flip it so that the weakest time was the strongest this time around and the strongest time will be the weakest? Or is this a new bull market in which it just keeps going up regardless of seasonality and the structure of the futures market and, you know, the things that used to or normally do affect short-term price movements. And we'll find out in January, because normally January is when gold and silver just pop every single year. You know, you could go back for the last 10 years and play that trend where you buy it in December, sell it in February or March, and that's all you do in precious metals. And you would make the whole year's move
right
by in that 3 month period. So I'm really interested to see what's going to happen in January. And if they, you know, if gold and silver pop, that's a really good sign, because that means seasonality really no longer matters to the downside.
Yeah.
In other words, weak seasonality is going to be offset by buying from other sources out there. And then it's off to the races. We're back in a bull market, and gold and silver bull markets are spectacular. They're kind of rare. You know, we had one in the 70s, we had one in the 2000s. But both times they were life-changing events for stackers and other gold bugs, right? You know, you could have made a ton of money by being really long precious metals in either of those markets. So it's completely possible that we have another one of those coming. And I think early 2020 will give us a big clue as to whether that's the case.
All right. Well, then let me ask you point number three, because I wanted to get your feedback on this. People on my site, I mean, they hear me talk about this all the time, so they know what I think. But I think it's obviously valuable to hear what other people think, too, because God knows I don't have all the answers. So I've been, you know, many people that are in the shares have been somewhat frustrated this year because, you know, 15, 20% move in gold, about that in silver. But yet, you know, the shares are up 40 or 50% instead of maybe 100. I attribute that to my friend Grant Williams. Remember him? He had that great presentation back in 2016 about nobody cares, right? Remember that? And, you know, and even Rick, I think that was, I can't remember if you were on that podcast with me a couple months back with Rick Rule. And Rick talked about how the global asset allocation to the precious metal sector peaked at 8% in 1980, and it fell as low as 0.5% last year, and had been there for a couple of years. But the median was 2.5%. And if we just go back toward that median, I mean, we're talking 3-4 times the amount of cash in the sector that's there now, coming into the sector, looking for what is really a finite number of opportunities. And so I'm kind of preparing for, since I think prices are going to hold here and extend higher, I'm preparing once we get into the first quarter of next year and some of these earnings reports, you know, for the second quarter in a row or, you know, 4 and 5 times year over year, for, you know, where they were last year. I just think there's a potential for a little mini avalanche is too strong of a term, but, you know, a rush of money suddenly to come in like we saw in 2016. So anyway, here I went explaining myself again, for God's sake. But I guess this is all in the form of a question, John. What do you think of all that? Is that something that sounds reasonable to you?
Oh, yeah, very reasonable. Gold and silver miners are extremely leveraged plays on the price of gold. In other words, if gold or silver go up by, let's say, 20 or 30%, that might quadruple the earnings of a typical gold or silver miner. So you got these guys reporting big beats on their earnings quarter after quarter. In other words, they do way better than anybody expects. And that attracts non-precious metals centric money. Because there are a lot of people out there who are basically momentum players. They're looking for things that that are going up faster, at a faster rate over time. And they don't care about gold mining. That could be a cement company, or it could be, you know, a brokerage house stock or something like that. As long as it's moving in that kind of a trajectory, they will jump into it. So you get this new money coming into it. What is a really, really thinly traded small sector of the stock market? And that lights a fire under these stocks. You know, it's easy to see the typical junior miner going up 3 or 4 or 5 times from where it is right now. And the bigger miners can easily double from here without anything really remarkable happening in the world. You know, just a somewhat higher gold and silver price, which leads to dramatically higher earnings for these guys. And, you know, the rest of the world doesn't have to change all that much, but you'll see those stocks take off. Now, that's something that's happened a few Januaries in the last few years. You know, it's easy to picture it happening this time around because the fundamentals are so much better, in the sense that rising metals prices are leading to rising earnings for these companies. But there's a stage after that that I want to be here for, you know, when money from basically everywhere starts pouring into gold and silver. And you've already got the beginnings of that with mainstream money managers like Ray Dalio talking about how people should have 10% of their portfolios in gold. Now, as you said, maybe 1% of global investable funds are in precious metals right now. So if you went from 1% to 10%, actually, that would probably be impossible. I don't think you could get the metals to allow that to happen at anything like today's prices. You would have to be in the stratosphere with gold and silver to accommodate 10% of global investable capital. But, you know, as you said, even if it's just 2 or 3%, that is a massive shift of money into what are very small markets. So we'll see precious metals go up, and we'll see the miners turn into like dot-coms for a while, where anything with gold and silver in the name automatically is worth twice as much this year as it was last year. And see, that's a challenge for stock pickers in this sector, because you want to be in the best quality stocks, right? But people have done studies that that concluded for 1 or 2 years in the most rip-roaring part of a precious metals bull market, the crappy gold and silver miners go up even more because their stocks were way down to begin with, right? So it's really easy. If something's gone from $2 to 30 cents a share, it's really easy for it to double back up to 60 cents a share, but it's still down. You know, it's still not a good company. But that's where an actual ton of money in percentage terms are made. And so that it's kind of... it's an intellectual challenge knowing that, because it's tempting just to go out and buy any name in the space and assume that the, you know, the bad miners will for a little while go up more than the good miners. So it's hard to make mistakes, right? Unless they go bankrupt during that time, you tend to make a ton of money. Which is, that's basically a problem that a stock picker would love to have, right? Everything's going up. So which will go up the most? And it's not always an intuitive call. But anyhow, so that kind of a day is coming, I think.
If we summarized, I mean, it would just be like, well, let's just see what happens here over the next 60 days or so and how we begin 2020. And especially, you know, that by January and early February, all the majors will be reporting fourth quarter earnings, you know, and you get 2 quarters in a row of blowout earnings, and you get the sector, you know, everybody reading their Investor's Business Daily and on New Year's Eve, realizing that the mining sector is one of the top, if not the top sector. I mean, you can kind of see where this would come together. So I guess what I would say, you know, the time for people to kind of pay attention and make a decision whether this is something they want to, you know, try to take advantage of would be over the next couple of months.
Historically, if you're just looking at seasonality in precious metals, now is the time to be loading up, because December is your last chance to get it before it really pops in January. And, you know, I want to be really clear. I'm not saying go out and mortgage the house and buy gold and silver right now. Never do anything like that, especially when you, just because you heard somebody on the radio say do it. But historically, this is the month when, had you bought a lot of precious metals related assets, you did really well in the next few months. And there, as you said, there's no reason to think that the fundamentals won't be good in January and February, because we'll see earnings reports that are basically pretty good to spectacular, depending on the company. And that will create a tailwind for these stocks. So I'm cautiously optimistic going into the seasonally strong period, but you got to remember that the seasonally weak period was strong this time, and that could mean one of two things: either seasonality doesn't matter anymore, or we're off to the races. And the seasonality doesn't matter anymore thing is always possible. So we shouldn't be too excited about this, but we should be cautiously optimistic that the next few months are going to be fun ones for precious metals in general.
Yeah, it could just be all of a sudden people just want gold and silver in all their forms, you know, whether it's the physical metal or the derivative or the unallocated account or the mining share or whatever. More and more people are seeing what's coming. And you're right. I mean, it's always physical precious metal as a protection about what we began this podcast discussing. But it's just, you know, if you want to try to make a little fiat in your IRA or something like that, maybe now's the time to pay attention.
Yeah, Craig, if we have a couple of extra minutes, that's a really important point, because precious metals, they're not all the same thing. You know, for instance, physical gold and silver are money that compete against the dollars in your bank account or under your mattress or wherever. So you want those as cash replacements, and you don't expect them to make you massive capital gains. You expect them to preserve your purchasing power while the dollar is falling in value. Now, to make actual big capital gains, the stocks, which are investments rather than money, are where you look. Yeah. But they carry a lot of risks that are independent of the money market. In other words, gold and silver are basically going to preserve your purchasing power if you store them in a safe place, yada, yada. But mining stocks, any individual mining stock can just vaporize. It can go away because of non-related issues. And it could be in a brokerage account that gets confiscated in a really crazy world or something like that, where the government comes in and says, oh, we're taking your stocks and we're going to replace them with government bonds. And that's a completely conceivable scenario in, you know, the Mad Max part of the spectrum of financial crisis out there. So you don't want to load up on anything financial in a brokerage house or a bank account until you've nailed down all the cash in the form of gold and silver that you want to nail down. In other words, that's the thing that happens first. Buy a lot of precious metals, store them safely, and then the bedrock asset in your portfolio is pretty safe. And then you can go speculate
right
on these junior miners or whatever.
Yep. I think that's excellent. It's an excellent way to put it. John, you've been extraordinarily generous with your time. We've gone longer than I promised you that we would. We got to wrap up, but I have an old thing I used to do that I thought, yeah, I should start doing this again. And I didn't prep you for this. I apologize, but it's something I call the final four. A lot of folks used to like it when I would end up, finish up interviews with this. And it's just four quick questions that you can usually answer with like a yes or a no, or just a quick sentence. Just fun. You know, no one's going to hold you to this stuff, but it's just kind of a fun way to wrap up. If you don't mind, can I hit you with them?
Sure.
All right. The first one that I had for you was, we all think maybe China, Russia, combination, whatever, are going to offer some competing alternative to the dollar at some point. So if that were a scenario, would they do that just voluntarily on a Sunday, or would it be in response to a crisis?
Could be either.
Okay. I can live with that. In the next crisis, which do you think will be the first major bank to be in trouble?
Deutsche Bank. I think they're already in trouble.
All right. And then in terms of holidays, do you like fruitcake?
I do.
Huh. See, I never really, I don't know. I just never, it has a good fruitcake, you know. It's fruit, it's cake. It's not to like. And then finally, what's your favorite Christmas movie?
Ooh. The one with the little kid with the BB gun.
Yeah. Christmas Story.
Yeah. Okay.
Always a favorite. Do you have a leg lamp? That'd be question 4A.
A leg lamp?
Yeah. You know, like the dad got from Fragile, right? The leg with the stocking on it, and it's a lamp. The dad got.
Yeah. I wouldn't be allowed to have one of those. Yeah.
All right, my friend, dollarcollapse.com, correct? That's where we need to start checking if you're not already.
Okay. Thanks, Craig.
Hey, John, thank you for your time. And hey, thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll have another Thursday conversation next week.